Welcome to this edition of the Beef Roundtable. I'm Dr. Ron Luminager, Beef Extension Specialist here at Purdue University, West Lafayette, Indiana. And I'll be working with my co-host, Bert Rutherford.
And I'm Bert Rutherford, Senior Editor at Beef Magazine. I'm based in Denver, Colorado. Each month on the Beef Roundtable, we discuss current topics with leaders in the beef industry that concern all producers, really everybody in the beef business.
The Beef Roundtable is recorded live and edited to fit the time constraints of the program. The programs are available at the Beef Magazine website, iTunes, YouTube.com, as well as www.beefroundtable.com.
Our topic for today's edition of the Beef Roundtable is the National Beef Quality Audit, which was released this past summer. This is the sixth audit completed in the last 25 years, one every 5 years. And collectively, those audits tell us where we are in the beef business, where we've been, and where we need to go. Really, over those last 25 years, they have really made a significant impact on where we're headed with ultimately our beef product.
Our first guest is Dr. Dan Niffen, a beef producer and Hereford breeder from Pennsylvania. He's also with Penn State University, and he's a beef extension specialist. Dan was the chairman of the National Beef Quality Audit, actually the National Beef Quality Assurance Advisory Board, and was a key leader from the producer perspective in the last National Beef Quality Audit.
Our second guest is Dr. Deb Van Overbeek, a meat scientist from Oklahoma State University. Deb was one of the principal investigators in the last two National Beef Quality Audit.
Well, let's begin our talk today about why the National Beef Quality Audit was conducted, okay, and has been conducted for the last 25 years. Who funds it and who is involved in the process? The industry needs a focus on continuous improvement, and give us a little bit of a background on that.
The beef quality audit, as you know, has been conducted for the last 25 years. And I guess from my perspective, it goes back to the old adage that if we don't measure it, we can't manage it. And so when you think about our opportunity to go out and have some snapshot data points on where we are as an industry, then that gives us some indicators where there's some opportunities for us to potentially make some improvements or make some changes as we move forward. And as you think about it, who in the industry, who in the country is going to be in a position to be able to go out and conduct such a project and get the data collected, and who is going to make the investment in that project? We're fortunate enough through our beef checkoff program that we've got that opportunity to direct those dollars to this program and be able to secure a partnership with several universities around the country that help us get that data collected. Most importantly, Colorado State and Oklahoma State have taken the lead in the current audit and helped us to assemble the data. But when it comes to making that investment, we as cattle producers have to be the people that step up to the plate and request to get that data collected simply because it is most valuable to us as an industry.
Dan, don't forget that Texas A&M is also a key player in the audit, and has been for several years. And then we also use other institutions, University of Nebraska, University of Florida, and many others that I won't list all of them for fear of leaving someone out, that help us get the in-plant portion of the audits done as well.
Thank you, Deb.
With all these different institutions really representing a pretty wide range of scientific knowledge, scientific involvement in the beef business, what information gets collected? How do we know, based on that information, that we really are making progress in producing better beef for our consumers?
Great question. I think first to answer kind of the kinds of information that gets collected, this is done as a three-phase project in essence and has been since 1991. Phase one being face-to-face interviews with industry. And when I say industry, I mean further down the chain. So packers, processors, retailers, food service operators, et cetera. Phase two being the in-plant audits. and then phase three being the strategy workshop where we summarize all that data and try to come home with that blueprint or the goals for the next 5 to 10 years.
How do you collect that information? I mean, you know, specifically, when you look through even the executive summary of this most recent National Beef Quality Audit, there is just a remarkable amount of information and amount of data in there. Where does that come from, and how do you get it?
So when we look at phase one in our face-to-face interviews, we had not quite 200 interviewees that we engaged in activity, and so that is actually a computer-based survey instrument that we use, but we do those in person. And we do that because we don't want them to sit there and ponder questions for a long time. We want their, off the top of the head, what does, for example, eating satisfaction mean to them? And so that meant the interview, those involved in the interviews, so primarily Oklahoma State, Colorado State, and Texas A&M did some of those as well. We would engage those in a 30 to 45 minute discussion, whether it was at conventions and conferences we went to, or we'd travel to go do those interviews as well, and just sit down with them and ask that buyer, hopefully we were meeting with the buyer of product, ask them those questions. And so that's how we captured the data for phase one. The in-plant audits, we're actually in those facilities for an entire day's production. So whether that's two shifts on a single day or a shift day one and another shift day two, however it works best with that plant, we were in the kill floor and in the cooler to gather that information. We also had people in the holding pens, and so it took quite a crew to be able to, if you were doing both the live animal portion and the cooler portion, it took quite a crew to get that project conducted. And that's why we engage other institutions to do those implant audits as well.
What was the third phase? You mentioned three phases.
Great question. The third phase is the strategy workshop. And for the strategy workshop, we did that last December, so December of 16, and we invited key players. And so we invited packers that we had been to those plants. We invited retail and food service who had done an interview in phase one, and we asked them to come see and hear the results of phase one and phase two and to help develop those strategies and tactics for the next 5 to 10 years. And so we had about 70 to 80 representatives in Denver with us for that strategy workshop. And for that, we go back upstream as well, and we invite producers to hear those results as well so that they're involved in helping develop those strategies for producers for the next before the next audit in essence.
So we've now identified three categories, okay? The face-to-face interviews, the implant survey data of carcass quality and live animal components, okay? So we'll get to those here in just a second, and then the strategy session. So let's start with the face-to-face interviews. What were some of the takeaways, the big things that popped out in the face-to-face interviews for this time, and maybe how that relates a little bit to previous audits?
Great question. So when we think about face-to-face interviews, first I want to preface that the last two audits we've done, that's when we've used that computer-generated system, and I'm going to talk about why that's important in a second. Previous to that, they were done via paper, and you just went and asked open-ended questions and took copious amounts of notes and then tried to summarize that. But the beauty of this computer system is that, one, it lets everyone define those terms. And so when we said the term, for example, food safety, we made them define it for their company. And so every packer might define that differently. Every food service operator might define that differently. Every retailer might define that differently. But we got their true meaning of what it meant to their business. And so we did that. We let them define our key buckets or our key terms and things as we got started. We're also able to capture from them when we do that the relative importance of those. And so going through a series of questions, asking them to rank most important and least important, we could actually take those seven buckets and rank them in terms of what is most important. And in this audit, it happens to be food safety, which relates is the same as what it was in 2011. But we are then able to capture, okay, we know it's important, so we know its definition. Is it worth anything? And so we're able to do a willingness to pay type question of, do you have things that you have to have, guaranteed things before you'll buy beef product. And if it can't be guaranteed, will you buy that at a discount? If you can't have it, well, then it's not really a must-have, so we're able to sort through that. And if it's not a must-have, what premium would they pay if they could be guaranteed that trait? And so we're able to go through a series of those things with those interviewees to figure out, yes, they say knowing source of origin, for example, is a requirement, but if I can't guarantee that, will they buy at a 5% discount? Would they buy it at 10% or 20% discount, or is it truly a must-have that they have to have in their business?
So what were your conclusions as you put all that data together? What conclusions can be drawn from the face-to-face interviews?
There's three big things. First, I'll talk about the leading two issues that they identify are their two most important traits, and that being food safety and eating satisfaction. And so to them, food safety is paramount. To them, I mean retail and food service, it's paramount. It's something that drives whether they're going to be in business or not, and so it's of vital importance. And they don't necessarily indicate that it's a must-have because there's no way to guarantee it, but they are willing to pay some premiums for it, not a huge amount, but they're a number of them are willing to pay a premium if it could be guaranteed. It's just a struggle of how you would guarantee something of that nature. And then eating satisfaction is an obvious one. And everyone defines that a little differently depending on who you're talking to. It's tenderness and flavor are the two most important traits, but those two might vary in terms of their rank as you look at who responded. And so is it a business where they can control what happens with that product? And so tenderness isn't as important, but flavor is. Or can they control the flavor? And so tenderness is important. And so those things vary. But those two don't surprise me as much because that's how it was in the last audit in 2011. Probably the thing that shocked me the most in terms of response is they believe that they're asking their suppliers to source product from a quality assurance program, but yet they don't tie that to beef quality assurance. That term to retail and food service doesn't mean anything. And so to me, that's a big marketing tool and a big takeaway from the audit, especially for the Beef Quality Assurance Program, is how do we market what we're doing with Beef Quality Assurance on farms, on ranches, in feedlots, so that they understand that we are doing those things that they're looking for in production.
Dan, let's follow up on that a little bit. More than 800 beef producers were also interviewed as part of the process. What conclusions can we draw from what beef producers, out in the country making the product, what they think, how they feel about it?
That's a good place to get into, Bert. But before we jump ahead, let me back up one step. And a couple points that Deb made, I think, are well worth reiterating. You know, she made the comment about us being able to sell beef products. And would they be interested in buying that product at a 5% or a 10% discount? I think to reiterate that point, we have to remember we can sell all the beef that we raise in this country at some price. And that's the critical part, at some price. And so as we continue to move forward and we look at these quality audits, then the question becomes, what can we do to make sure that that quality continues to stay at a high level so that we can command the value for our beef product as we move it forward? And I think that's important to remember. Back to the producer on the at home, and what can they do and how can they be involved? You know, there's several things that can happen. One of the things we learned in the audit was that, the number of major bruises that showed up in the audit this time around were less than they had been in previous years. And I think that's a key point, that we're able to reduce the severity of those bruises that we have. The part that was a little disconcerting to us was the fact that we actually saw more minor bruises as they went through the plants and looked at the cattle. And when you think about it, a couple things come to mind. First off, when you go back to the data, and correct me if I'm wrong, Deb, but we noticed that the carcass size on these cattle were larger. And we all know to have larger carcasses, we must have bigger cattle. And so when you think about it, and the cattle have gotten larger, our facilities probably have not changed much over the last 25 years. You get equipment in place, and as long as it's working and continues to function, It's not something that you go out and change every day of the week. So one of those things on the producer side we really need to pay attention to is that we make sure that that equipment, if it can be adjusted, is adjusted accordingly so that we're not bruising those cattle going through the facilities and helping to try to reduce that. Another opportunity that we have is that where the bruises were showing up on the cattle, there's been some speculation that we might actually be having some challenges when we're loading cattle. And these larger cattle fitting into those lower decks on these cattle trucks may be creating a little bit of a problem for us. Those cattle being taller may actually be rubbing their backs going into that lower deck in the pot. And so that's something that I think as producers we need to be sensitive to, that maybe one of those things we could do back home would be pre-sort that load of cattle ahead of time. And if we had some smaller framed or smaller cattle that we were going to put in the load, maybe we could set them aside and put them down in the belly of the truck to try and help alleviate some of that challenge that we have while we're loading cattle. Additionally, the data came back and told us that we have fewer cattle coming to the plants that have horns, but we still have cattle coming to the plant that have horns. And that may be one of those challenges that maybe we have to continue to pay attention to relative to making sure that when those cattle get into feedlots that we do have the horns off them, or when they're at weaning, making sure we have the horns off those cattle, just because from the daily rumble and tumble in the feedlot, you know, as we're setting pecking orders or getting to the feed bunk to get something to eat, those cattle with horns have got an opportunity to create some bruises on some of our other cattle in the feedlots. And so those are a couple of three quick points that maybe at home as producers we could give some consideration to.
So what are some of the key conclusions that can be drawn from the implant? You kind of related to the bruises, but, you know, since, you know, the first audit was conducted, you know, we've made significant strides in, I think, in beef quality and consistency. You know, talk about what we saw in the inside the plant as it relates to the both live animal, okay, on arrival, but also, you know, those carcasses that are hanging on the rail and we're putting quality grades and yield grades on them in addition to the bruises.
Great question. So let's look at the carcass first, because that's easy to see some improvements over time. So if you think about the 91 audit, we had all this excess fat. And we had okay quality grades, but not stellar. And so if I look back, previous audits in the 91 audit, we had 55% prime and choice. And if we look at 2016, that's up to 71%. And so we have made great strides in quality grade, for example, in that 25-year time frame. We have, at that same time, though, increased carcass weight. And so looking at 91, that carcass weight was about 760 pounds, and now we're at 860 pounds. So we've added 100 pounds. Did we add 100 pounds of fat? Probably not. We would have saw a big change in yield grade. But what we do see is we see a very consistent yield grade over that entire time. And so we don't stray much from that 2.9 to a 3.1 really realm. Cattle get bigger, we add some muscle, but we also add fat. And so not a big change there. But we do have a huge improvement in quality grade. We have less fours and fives probably than we saw in 1991. I don't have that figure right in front of me. But we do have that shift that we want to see in quality grade that packers can utilize and that retail and food service tell us they can use. Now, the fun discussion of that is trying to figure out what should we be producing, right? I mean, you don't know what you can sell until you produce it, but we did have 3.8% prime carcasses in 2016. To my knowledge, we didn't have a problem selling that, and so that's a good story. The question is, how did we go from 2.1% in 2011 to almost 4% in 2016? And some of that is just a change in what's out there for harvest, because we did have a lot more Holsteins in 2016 than we had in previous years. And we all know that Holsteins grade easier and will reach that prime quality grade easier than our other cattle that we're typically harvesting. So that, I mean, I think from a carcass standpoint, that's our big take-home message, is that we do have yes, we have larger carcasses, but we do have 71% prime and choice. Dan, you want to comment on that before I go back to the live animal part?
Actually, I was going to jump in, Deb, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought the data also mentioned that we're seeing less injection site blemishes on those carcasses when they were on the rails. And go ahead.
So we don't actually have injection site lesion data for fed steers and heifers. We can look for visible knots, which gives us that indication, but it's not, we can't say that there's less injection site lesions because we're not looking in those muscles. And so the most recent thing we have on fed steers and heifers relative to injection sites is the 2000 audit that we did in stake cutting plants. It's right about 2% injection site lesions in top butts. I know we're focusing on fed steers and heifers for this program, but we did actually go do a slice audit in cow plants in this past summer to kind of go along with the cow release of the audit that we did earlier this month at NCBA with the media. And we actually have a huge reduction of injection site lesions in cow rounds that we've had since 2000. And so that is a good story, probably not the focus of fed steer and heifers, but that's another story for another time for you guys.
I guess I was equating the fact that we weren't seeing as many knots on these cattle as potentially, hopefully hoping that we've reduced that injection site challenge that we had and we've made some headway.
We can hope for that. We just can't say that for certain.
I'm a cattle producer, Deb. I'm always optimistic.
Deb, you mentioned that 20% of the quality audit that was done, I think there was 20% Holsteins in that mix or thereabouts, right? That was,
yes.
That was
16% dairy animals in the cooler okay. Relative to the cooler portion of the audit.
And that was up from 2011. So what's going on there? Why do we see more Holsteins in this audit than previous audits? Do you have a feel for that?
I'm going to let Dan answer that.
Thanks. You know, part of it was we have seen that reduction in cow number across the United States. Four or five years ago, we had the smallest U.S. cow herd that we've had since 1949. So when we receive that, we see that reduction in number. You know, it's got to begin to have some impact on the cattle that are coming to town. Additionally, the U.S. dairy herd has increased in size some. And with that, we're seeing more black and white cattle that are actually being fed out versus winding up as veal. Our veal consumption in this country has declined. And with that decline, something has to happen with those cattle. And so they have continued to feed them out and move them forward. Hence, we're seeing more cattle. More black and white cattle coming in that are winding up on the rail as finished cattle. And, you know, part of it is, and Deb alluded to, but we can't completely discredit those cattle. If they're fed properly, they'll hang up some good carcasses. Yes, we have some issues with the loin being a little different shape than it is in our traditional beef cattle breeds. But, you know, the opportunity to be able to market that and the opportunity to have that beef to put on the table, you know, it helps us fill that demand. I don't ever want to be in a situation in this country where we've got a consumer who would really like to sit down and have a steak dinner and not have that product available to them. And so they do fill a void in our market, which, you know, properly managed, they can provide a satisfactory eating experience for our consumer.
Deb, let's talk a little bit about the live animal piece of this.
Absolutely. So this is the first time relative to phase one for fed steers and heifers, the first time in the audit that we've been in the holding pens. And so that's a little bit different scenario from a standpoint of we've never looked at mobility or trucking and transportation for phase one in fed steers and heifers. We've been in the holding pens for the cow audits, the cow and bull audits, but never for fed steers and heifers. And so if we start there, just looking at sheer time travel, dimension, I mean, there's lots of factors we can look at relative to transportation, but probably the biggest thing is as cattle size increases and we look at, for example, area allotted per head, we're allotting about 12.2 square feet per animal as it's being transported, and that's on average. There were some trucks that it was down to 9.2 square feet, some trucks we had 25 square feet. per animal that was on those trucks when they were delivered to the plant. We're only looking at 10% of each day's production, so there's not a whole lot. It's new, and so we're looking at a total of about 220 trucks evaluated in this data set. And so not that we have 1,000 trucks to average over, but we're getting them about is the keyword, to that allotted size that NAMI would recommend for transportation. The challenge is, if you look at that 12 square feet for NAMI, that's on a 1,000-pound animal. Mm-hmm. And obviously, when we have 860-pound carcasses, we're not dealing with 1,000-pound animals. And so we're pushing the limit, I think, on the amount of space we're allowing during transportation of these animals as we do get them bigger. It's also interesting to look on the fed steer and heifer side. You don't think of cattle being transported very far, typically. You think of more of that long-distance transportation with cows and bulls. But we had some fed steers and heifers that were transported 12 hours to get to a plant. The average is just under 3 hours of transportation and just under 135, 136 miles, roughly. But we are transporting some of them, 12 hours, 870 miles, I think, was our max distance traveled. And so we have transportation. We also looked at mobility. Obviously, a lot of focus on mobility the past few years, but not quite 97% of the cattle we looked at were a mobility score of 1, meaning they're normal, they walk easily, they come, and we did this as they were coming off the truck, and so very, no concerns with mobility that we saw at all. There were no downers, none of those that had a mobility score 4 where there's an extreme struggle to walk and they had to be encouraged to move at all. We do see 3% that had some minor stiffness, but that's really the biggest issue that we saw in terms of mobility.
Moving back inside the plant, most plants, I'm under the impression anyway, have gone to instrument grading for the cattle moving down the line. How accurate is instrument grading relative to the human eye?
Great question. So we were able to capture instrument grading data again this year, just like we did 5 years ago. And we captured that I'm going to get you the number just so I don't misquote it. On
4.5 million head, Deb.
Yes, that. I was looking to see. So when you consider that we were able to capture from several companies a week's worth of data for a month, within a month. And so over time, we looked at that. And you have very little difference between the camera data and the data we collected as our snapshot. And so the camera system is very accurate. Our snapshot gives us that same accurate image. The beauty of that camera data is it allows us to look at things on kind of a month basis and see some trends over time. And so there's some nice data in that camera data. It doesn't differ a whole lot than what we found during our implant visits.
The other thing about that camera data is it can really help build your confidence. If you're one of those individuals that's marketing cattle on a grade and yield, and then you're wondering whether or not they're getting accurate data collected, boy, this really can build your confidence, and you can be reassured that our USDA graders are doing an excellent job of getting those cattle identified when they're going by. And so, you know, as an individual who might be shipping cattle and then wondering whether or not those grades are actually accurate, or, you know, there's always people that want to speculate as to where the shortcuts are in the plant, you know, and are they grading my cattle back a little bit so they don't have to pay me so much for. No, that's not the case. After looking at 4 or 5 million head of cattle, you know, the team was able to identify that those in-plant graders are doing a great job. And, you know, the nice thing about that camera, it never has a bad day unless the electric goes off. But if the electric goes off, there won't be any cattle going by anyhow. So it's actually a real nice reassurance that that we are getting those cattle graded correctly.
So the third part of this National Beef Quality Audit was kind of the strategy session where you brought in, you know, 70 or 80 people, Deb, I think you said. You know, so what were the results of that collective thinking of the data that had been generated and where we need to go from here?
Great question. So when you look at the summary information from the Fed steer and heifer audit, we looked at three real main categories for focused improvement, those being food safety and animal health, eating quality and reduction of variety, and then third, optimizing value and eliminating waste. And so when we look at those, we could break those down specifically, but if you look at those, it's, am I marketing those appropriately? Am I using genetics and sorting techniques that would help me gain efficiency and productivity? Am I treating those, for example, from the food safety animal health, am I treating those appropriately if they do get sick? Am I following withdrawal times? All those types of things would be included. Obviously, eating quality and reduction of variety focuses on eating satisfaction. And then what's in a box? And that was a big take home and a big push from food service and retail of what's in a box. I don't mind if I buy heavy ribeyes. I don't mind that there's heavy ribeyes in there. But is my ribeye area going to be 9 square inches and then 18 square inches? Or can I at least kind of scale that down and have some similarity in a box? I think retail and food service has given up on the weight issue. Based on their discussion, they said, you know, we're going to have heavyweight carcasses. It's just, can I have them all the same when I get them? So can I have some consistency when I get them to my place for further use? You know, the final part of that really is calculating some lost opportunities in terms of a take home for producers. So what are we producing from phase two? So looking at frequencies in phase two and comparing that, what should we be producing or what can we utilize from an end user standpoint? And we've calculated these lost opportunities since the original audit. But when we look at those for quality grade, yield grade, weight, hide damage, and then offal condemnations, we're losing about $49.06 for every steer and heifer harvested in 2016 for quality defects. And so, granted, some of those you may not qualify as defects, right? We're producing select yield grade twos. Yes, someone's going to use them, but we could really use some more prime yield grade threes. And so, That's the give and take of that scenario.
So how's that compared to previous audits? So, you know, you said, you know, dollar wise, are we making progress in that? And because I think it's a kind of a collective term, right? Okay, you know, lost value.
And we've been able to go back and make some adjustments and compare those over time. I mean, 2011, that was $47.30. The biggest loss. The biggest category for lost ground, if you will, from 2011 to current is yield grade and carcass weight. And so we do have more fours and fives, and we do have more heavyweight carcasses. And partly that calculation goes based on what do those end users tell us they can use. And so they agreed at the strategy workshop that they don't want carcasses over 1,000 pounds anymore. And so they're willing to accept 900 to 1,000 pound carcasses, but when you look at the consensus that they developed in terms of what's that target production frequency, the last audit, 2011, they said, you know, we'll take a few that are 1,000 to 1,050, and this year they said, no, we can't, they're too big, we can't deal with cuts from carcasses that are that large. And so that's why weight gets thrown in there so much and almost doubles in terms of loss value.
Well, Dan, let me throw a follow-up to you then on this one, because, you know, if you look at Tyson, for example, and the closest plant that I've got here is Joslin, Illinois, and they're not applying discounts until we get to 1050 carcass weights. So do you think, based on the quality audit, that we're going to adjust the carcass weight premium discount, if you will, at the packer because of this current audit?
You know, the challenge we get into, Ron, and this happens every time we go through this process, and every time you sit and listen to Cattle Facts talk about profitability in the feeding sector, and the one piece of information that continually comes back to us is bigger cattle make more money. And so as we continue to be paid first on weight, then you've got some real challenges to go back and tell the producer, hey, we'd really like to cut 100 pounds off those cattle before they come to town. And, you know, so rather than setting those 1400s, can you get them out of there at 1300? So we fall into our carcass specs a little better. And so until we start sending different signals back, Ron, we're going to have trouble getting people to actually start marketing lighter cattle. And, you know, probably the time that we saw the biggest change in carcass weights was, you know, when we were bumping up against $7-$8 corn, and then we were getting cattle out of the yards a little sooner and getting those cattle to town. But as long as we're living on cheaper feed and it continues to pay to put the extra 10 pounds on, then you can't hate producers for doing that, because they're just trying to optimize a revenue source. And so that's one of those things we're going to be struck with, you know, as an industry, until we finally get to that point where some major discounts start coming to town on those cattle.
Well, and
the other place where we see a huge change from 2011 to 2016 is offal condemnations, partly because the price of those products has increased, but we have a huge increase in liver condemnations, which typically get associated with dairy animals, but also because of our change in feed additives and what we're allowed to use, we're going to see that trend increase, I think. And so I don't know if Dan wants to comment from a production standpoint on that, but you do have a driving force of liver condemnations that's driving that number up as well.
And that's going to be continued to be one of our challenges that we're going to have as an industry. And, you know, and as we look at consumer demands on these never ever cattle, and then can we feed products that are in a position to help us improve liver quality, then, you know, you've got a give and take scenario that we've got to deal with as we continue down the road. And that's going to be some of those places where we're going to have to figure out opportunities that we have to maybe help control the livers that we're using. Yes, admittedly, we don't eat 100 pounds of liver a piece a year in this country, but, you know, there's countries that consume a lot of liver. And that adds a significant amount of money to the bottom line on those carcasses when we harvest them. You know, and if you stop and think about the livers that get sent out of this country, and if we can change the value on those from 95 cents to $2.95, well, then that has a significant impact. On an individual animal, maybe not so much. But then when we think about harvesting somewhere between 550 and 650,000 head of cattle in this country a week, you know, that number starts to come home that, hey, even a couple dollars is a significant amount of money when we start talking about the numbers of cattle that we are talking about. Another thing, go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to go in a different direction.
Well, so was I. I was going to ask, you know, a lot of this discussion that we've had here, it's certainly the National Beef Quality Audit. You know, we're looking at those carcasses in plant. We're talking to the packers. You're talking to retailers. But, you know, we've had a beef quality assurance program here in the cattle business for quite some time. And it may be that, you know, the guy out there on the farm or ranch who's just trying to do things right might have a hard time tying in what he or she does there relative to what the beef quality audit is showing us in the plant and ultimately for consumers. So that's a long way of asking, where does BQA fit in here and why is it important? Why should we care about it?
And, you know, the story I've told is that this is really a double-edged sword. And if you stop and think about it, aren't we glad that BQA isn't the topic of discussion every day a week or every day of the week around our U.S. beef supply? And the reason it isn't, we don't have any major problems that we're trying to deal with. Maybe the reason we don't have those is because we have good BQA programs in place, and they are actually helping to reduce those challenges or defects that may be coming down the line. And so it's the same old story. You don't hear much about it because it's working. You know, it would be nice to put us in a position that consumers could better understand the value of our quality assurance programs in this country, the care that our producers take when they're raising these animals, and the programs that they have in place to assure that we're delivering that high quality beef product. the flip side of it is they're having good dining experiences. We're not having major food safety issues in this country. And that's the good message. And so BQA is working so well, we don't hear anything about it. Yes, we've got to start talking about it. Yes, we've got to start getting the message out. But retrospect, I'm kind of glad that it's not one of those high talking point issues, simply because that tells you we're not having major problems right now.
And I think the quality audit kind of supports that, Dan, you know, that we are making some improvement. I mean, early on, we focused a lot on in our BQA programs about injection site blemishes and residues and locations of where we gave shots. And the whole BQA program has moved significantly past that. I mean, it's still part of it, but now we're into well-being. And we've incorporated the mobility scores and the, you know, in this last audit. Why? Because, you know, a couple years ago, we kind of had some issues with some cattle in the hot part of the summer that were heavyweights, that were dark-hided cattle that probably exhibited some heat stress because of the weather that we were dealt with. And we had some mobility issues for a period of time, okay? And so I think kudos to the organizers of this round of the National Beef Quality Audit and the principal investigators, Deb, you know, that led this charge, because, you know, I think we've said, you know, we're at about 99.6 or 99.8% of the cattle are mobility scores ones and twos, okay? I mean, virtually nothing in the three and four category that we thought maybe there was a concern, or at least people had expressed maybe there was a concern there. It's just not showing up.
Right. I think you can look at the whole audit series, the kind of the 25 years of history, and see the impact that beef quality assurance has made. I mean, from when I was an educator at Nebraska Cattlemen, I mean, yeah, the national guidelines haven't changed, but our focus on programming sure has, and that kind of reflects where the issues are and where we see the national, where the trends are headed in terms of what the issues are going to be down the line.
One of the things that I saw as I read through the executive summary, and Dan, you might, you know, being a seed stock producer selling bulls to commercial cattlemen, you know, one of the things that you know, in terms of that lost opportunity was quality grade, yield grade, right? And maybe yeah. Weights. You know, so as a producer, what can I do to facilitate, you know, an improvement in those two areas?
And, you know, the first thing you got to do is, if you're a commercial cow-calf producer, you've got to be able to find a seed stock provider or a genetics provider who is conscientious about where the industry needs to move. And, you know, when individuals come in to look at cattle or they come in to look at bulls, sometimes I'm really surprised at how little data they're really interested on those bulls. They basically still, I would say 95% of the bulls are still picked on visual assessment. And so as a seed stock producer, you need to be in a position to produce those genetics or have those genetics available that are going to move the needle on our industry, and understand that there may not be a whole lot of people that are interested in discussing that with you. But that as a industry provider, you just need to take that forward step and be able to have those genetics available. And it's kind of like, you know, slipping them their cough medicine with the ice cream, and they don't realize they're getting something better to help them. All they know is that they picked out the one they wanted. And so it's as the part of the industry that provides those genetics back, we've just got to take that step. Take that upper road, take the high road, and make sure that we're producing the kind of cattle that are going to help the entire industry move forward.
Well, and I would add to it, you know, and you didn't mention it quite by name, but you know, heterosis is something that can help us, I think, in terms of some of these carcass parameters as well. Okay, so crossbreeding, right?
Absolutely. You know, that's one of those traits where, you know, Ron, back when you and I were in school back in the dark ages, you know, we all studied heterosis and knew about heterosis. And here we were, I don't know, what was it, 8, 10 years ago? The BIF conference actually focused completely on heterosis, and it was almost like they were reintroducing heterosis back to the cattle industry. And you know, and I'm not picking on any one breed, don't misunderstand me, but as the, you know, back in our day, when you drove across the country, the color of cattle that was out in the field was a rainbow effect, that we had automatic heterosis in those cattle because we had different genetics in our cattle. Now, when you go across the country and look at our U.S. cow herd, you know, it has gotten considerably blacker than it used to be 25, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And you think about that, you know, and the thing that it has brought forward to us is it has reduced the genetic pool some, so that from a commercial cow manager perspective, you have less variation to deal with in that genetics that you're trying to manage. But from a production and optimizing production position, then we have given up on all those free gains, all that free lunch that we used to get in the cattle business that we called heterosis. You know, you look back at the cattle or the corn industry, excuse me, if heterosis wasn't working, we wouldn't have all the hybrid corn we've got in this country. And I would challenge you to go find one serious corn producer in the United States that isn't raising hybrid corn.
Now that we've completed 6 national beef quality audits over the last 25 years, what are the main take-home points from that effort? You know, what really focusing again back on the ranch and farm, what can we do to continue to get better?
You know, I think one of the take-homes is that improvement's not doing one thing 100% better, but doing a bunch of things just a little bit better. And that will make a difference. But if you think of one big thing that we can start doing is just simply talking about what we do relative to beef quality assurance. That came out big from phase 1 that no one, even packers sometimes struggled with the term beef quality assurance in terms of what they were expecting from producers. But sure, you get beyond that retail food service, they don't have a clue really that we're doing it and caring about production of livestock. And so I think simply sharing that message is a huge thing for the future. And then we just continue to monitor where we're at with the next audit in 5 years.
I think another one of those issues that comes home, especially from the production side, and I know this isn't going to make me the favorite person in town, but, you know, we've got to start thinking about animal ID. And as we start thinking about the information that we can pass forward on these individual animals and our ability to trace back some of these individual animals is going to go miles to helping us open up our global markets. And there's a demand for that kind of information. And I know that's not a favorite term with a lot of the producers out in the country because they're not interested in having to do something to identify those animals. But when I looked back in the audit, and correct me, Deb, but I think 65, 66% of the cattle that came to town had some form of identification on those cattle, which means we're moving in that direction. We're doing a good job of getting that done. So, you know, as we continue to take those next steps, I think there's going to be some opportunity. My other position in all that has been that, you know, when the economic drivers, the economic signals start to tell us that we need that information or that information will open up the marketplace to us, then those that are the early adopters will be able to reap the benefits of that identification. And if it adds to the value of those cattle, then it won't be long. The industry will come along and we'll be able to get a program in place, or producers will start figuring out how to have a program in place so that we can help move that information forward.
Any last comments from either one of you relative to the audit? Or?
Well, I would just, as a follow-up, right, so we can't forget that it's funded by Beef Checkoff, and so without that, we wouldn't be able to do these audits every 5 years. And so I think my summary points on improvements have been made, just making that final comment of thanks to NCBA for letting us continue to do the project and the funding from the beef producers to get it done.
And actually, I was going to come in the same place, Deb, and I was going to say, you know, it's thank God we've got a good beef checkoff program in this country and the producers are still supporting it, because it's those available dollars which allow us to do this, you know, and it's through the beef board and the operating committee that they see value in being able to have this information. And, And hopefully the people that are making those decisions, which are producers, will continue to see the value of these programs and continue to put money in there so that every 5 years we can get the yardstick out and see what's going on. We don't have to guess. We can know.
Well, and the bottom line is that it's this kind of information that's critical to holding consumer demand steady or increasing it, right, when it's all said and done. I mean, it's about consumer confidence. It's about consumer demand. Okay, and without doing these kinds of things and what the checkoff dollars allow us to do, you know, nobody else is going to spend the money to do it, right? So it's really critical that we've got this program in place. Well, that about wraps it up. Go ahead.
Well, let me just, one quick one. I was just going to say that that's absolutely correct. But it's not only our consumer in this country, Ron. A lot of times we just think about the consumer here. This is what's going to help us open up these global markets. Look at the quality of the product that we have available. Look at this, the eating satisfaction we can provide. And so as we continue to take these measurements, it also becomes an international marketing tool for us. So fortunately, you know, we've seen the value in this over the last 25 years to be able to get this data collected. And just one quick point, Deb, thank you for all your efforts, because I know you have been involved in many of these, not everyone, but many of these. You're not old enough to have been in all of them, so.
That's right. And I just remind anyone that's listening or watching, if you want more information, if you go to bqa.org, the full executive summaries for the Fed steer and heifer audit as well as the cow audit are online.
Very good. Thank you both for being our guests today. And as Deb said, okay, the National Beef Quality Audit executive summary is at her website, and we're also going to put it on beefroundtable.com website. So, you know, feel free to go to that, you know, and learn more about what we discussed today. Please join us next month for another look at the issues and trends that affect you. Thank you for joining us.